Welcome to We Are Change Fresno on 1680 AM. I'm your host, Drew Webb, along with my co-host, Sam Chaney, and our producer, Woody. Folks, we're on, I believe, week 18 of the show, and we'd like to thank our sponsors and our listeners for supporting the show. This couldn't happen without you guys, so we appreciate it. And be the change you want to see in the world by supporting independent media and real people, and not just fake plastic politicians and newscasters. So, folks, we have a special guest on this first hour of our two-hour broadcast. His name is James Corbett. He produced the documentary called The Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. James, how's it going today?
It's doing pretty good. How are things in Fresno?
Oh, well, we're still dry out here. We need some rain. As you might have known, we're suffering from a drought here, and it's going to be bad if we don't get some rain. But other than that, we're doing pretty good.
Well, that's good.
Hi, James. This is Sam. Big fan of your work. I've been following you for a long time. I think I first heard of you or saw your work introduced through Tragedy and Hope, and so I appreciate that work, too. So you just want to get right into it, the Federal Reserve, your documentary movie that you made, Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. It's a lot of information to cover.
It is, isn't it?
It certainly is, and we hound about it every week on our show about the Federal Reserve, about how Americans need to be aware of our monetary system. A little bit about my background, James, is I graduated from university here at Fresno State with a degree in economics and accounting, and part of my economics education there was taking a field trip to the San Francisco Federal Reserve, and it was very interesting there, and so I just wanted to let you know about that. We got to walk through through one of the floors there and saw how they processed the money, and their money-destroying machine, how they turn the Federal Reserve debt notes into confetti. And they make the workers in one of the rooms, because of high security reasons, they make them wear nothing but a tank top and shorts. I thought that was rather funny. But I asked them, the PR lady that was giving us the tour, I asked them, you know, is this a private corporation? And they gave me the answer that, no, this is a quasi-governmental agency. And so could you speak a little bit to that? Because I took it as a straight-out lie, and I told all my economics professors, because I had read Creature from Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin and The Secrets of the Federal Reserve by Eustace Mullins. I had read those books, and I knew the truth about it, but they continued to lie to us. And so can you speak a little bit about that, how they're not a quasi-governmental agency?
Well, quasi-governmental is such a quasi-answer that I guess it could mean anything depending on what they want it to mean. So I think that's how they get around it. To be as accurate as we can, we could say that the Federal Reserve itself is not a bank. The Federal Reserve is a system, and that system includes the Federal Reserve regional banks, like the San Francisco Fed that you visited, which themselves are private banks. However, the system also includes a board of governors and a Federal Open Market Committee in Washington, D.C., that is nominally, the Board of Governors is appointed by the president, and the FOMC consists of members of that board, as well as members of the regional banks. So there is a mishmash of private and supposedly public interests, although I think it would be naive to think that the president is really selecting people for the board who have not been pre-approved by the bankers themselves. But it's important to understand that the system has been made quite complex in some ways, if you want to drill down into the details. For example, the boards of the privately owned Federal Reserve regional banks themselves are populated by a mishmash of different categories of board members, including members of large banks, members of small banks, and members that are mandated to not be in the banking industry from some other industry. And they, them together, make up the boards of the privately owned Federal Reserve Reserve regional banks, which contribute to the Federal Open Market Committee. So it is quite complex the way it has been set up. But I think that the underlying point is twofold. One is that the regional banks themselves are private interests. And this, again, has been admitted by the Federal Reserve's own senior counsel, Yvonne Mizusawa, in a clip that I include in the documentary, in which she explains that the persons under FOIA do not include the Federal Reserve Bank member banks, because the stock is owned by the member banks in the district, 100% privately held. They are private boards of directors, according to Yvonne Mizusawa. So that's the one side of it. The other side of it is to say that it is true that the Federal Reserve was created through an act of Congress. So in that sense, it is a government created entity at any rate. And the flip side of that is that an act of Congress could end the Federal Reserve as well.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I think that is what people don't really understand is that Congress created it, but that means that Congress can get rid of it, even though it is a quasi-government agency, which is, you know, what is it, like you said, what does that even mean? It appearing to be, I mean, they're dodging the question. But could you speak a little bit about, for our listeners, what actually went into the Federal Reserve Act? I mean, does it make them essentially above the law does it make it basically above the law unless Congress abolishes it, in a sense?
That is the way that, at any rate, that is the way it's being interpreted right now. So, for example, I include a clip, I think a particularly revealing clip in the documentary of a confrontation between Senator Bernie Sanders and Ben Bernanke upon the release of a GAO, a Government Accountability Office report in June 2012 that came to some pretty startling conclusions about the conflicts of interests that are inherent in the Federal Reserve system, and the fact that you have the Federal Reserve regional banks are populated, the boards are populated by private bankers, and then these are the people who get to decide where the bailout funds go. So I talk about some examples in the documentary there. For example, Jeffrey Immelt, who was the CEO of General Electric, sitting on the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which itself directed $16 billion in emergency financing to General Electric during the bailout session. Or Jamie Dimon, of course, the chief of J.P. Morgan Chase, who was also sitting on the New York Fed, who directed $391 billion in Fed emergency lending to his own bank. So those types of conflicts of interest were pointed out in this GAO report that talked about $16 trillion of bailout monies that were distributed during that crisis. And Ben Bernanke was talking to Bernie Sanders about this, and I include the clip in the documentary where he says, Senator, you raised an important point, which is that this is not something the Federal Reserve created. This is in the statute. Congress, in the Federal Reserve Act, said this is the governance of the Federal Reserve, and more specifically, that bankers would be on the board. And they get into a talk about 6 out of 9 of the board members are bankers. So he says, that's correct, and that is in the law. And then he goes on to say, if Congress wants to change it, of course, we will work with you to find alternatives. So basically, I mean, it's openly admitted by the former Federal Reserve chairman himself. It is in the law. It's part of the statute. It's part of the act. It's the way the system was constructed that bankers would have the majority say over whatever was happening in these regional reserve banks, which themselves get to direct this emergency lending and the bailouts and all of that, which is really what the heart of this system is. It was in 1913, the Federal Reserve Act was passed as a way for the bankers to monopolize the money supply itself of the country, the creation of the money, the overseeing and regulation of the banks, and basically complete control over the industry which they are participating in, but an industry that itself is the very basis of the economy. So the power that was handed over to these private interests in 1913 is almost unimaginable, and that's why there was such secrecy and such duplicity in the creation and passage of the act.
Yeah, and in your documentary, you talk a little bit about how when the Federal Reserve Act was created at that time period, people actually hated the idea of central banks, but then they liked the idea of a government central bank because it would appear that they'd be able to control it through their congressmen. I mean, you know, governance by the people. But that's not how the law was written. So is that kind of how they snuck a fast one past everyone? Is they say, oh, we'll start a government central bank that you guys control, but really the Congress wrote in the law that, you know, it's supposed to be run by private bankers, not the people, you know?
Right. That's essentially exactly how it took place, because the idea, there had been, as I go over in the first section of the documentary, there had been a long history of various central banks that had come and gone in America, but there had not been one since the Second Bank of the United States was killed by President Jackson back in 1836. And in that intervening time, there had been a number of panics and runs and various things. But in 1907, there was a particularly bad crisis on Wall Street that threatened to collapse the entire American economy. And that crisis really precipitated the idea in the general public, oh, we need some sort of government agency. We need some sort of central bank to be the lender of last resort and to make sure this type of thing doesn't happen. So the 1907 crisis precipitated this idea, and it was ultimately, there was a proposal that was offered by Senator Aldrich that was directly from the bankers themselves. I talk about the Jekyll Island meeting from which that came, that was ultimately scuttled. That did not pass in Congress because people understood Senator Aldrich was very much connected into the banking industry and, of course, famously became the father-in-law of John D. Rockefeller Jr. as his daughter married John D. So that was ultimately scuttled. And then what was brought in as a replacement for that was a different act that basically incorporated most of the same elements, but had more of a window dressing of there's going to be a sort of public overview of this system. And that's where we get this idea of what is called a decentralized central bank. And again, it's the idea that there's what's happening in Washington, the Board of Governors and the Federal Open Market Committee, and then there's the regional banks. And there's supposed to be some interplay there between public and private interests as what was seen or what was touted as something of a compromise, I guess, between the idea of a completely banker-owned and operated central bank and one that was completely public. And that was a compromise that the people at the time were generally happy enough with. There was a lot of popular support for that idea and for Wilson's championing of that bill. And ultimately it got passed. And as I point out in the documentary, it was really duplicity from the very inception. In fact, if you even go back to that original crisis, the 1907 panic that kicked off the crisis that created this supposed need for the central bank in the first place, that can actually be traced back to J.P. Morgan. And there have been a lot of people over the years who have compiled various pieces of evidence that it was Morgan, in fact, who actually precipitated that crisis in order to crusade for the creation of a central bank that he ultimately ended up having a great degree of interest in through his Morgan Bank.
James, you know, it's hard to get people interested in economics and monetary policy when you would think it would be the exact opposite, because that's what the majority of people spend the most of their time trying to do in this country is earn a buck. And so how do we make it exciting? Me, I'm an economic nerd, right? I went and majored in it in college. I liked it so much because I wanted to understand what the heck's running this system. And so, but how do we, for the general dumbed down masses out there who just like football and fluoride water, how do we get them interested in economics and an understanding about the dollar and what's really the economic engine driving the majority of time of their life that they spend out here in the United States trying to earn a buck? How do we get people excited and interested in wanting to learn about it?
Well, that's such an important question, but I think we have to think about that question in its historical context, because as I try to point out in the documentary, if you look at the history of the United States from its inception up until the midpoint, or up until really the creation of the Federal Reserve, the idea of the monetary policy, the creation of money, the banking system, was really at the heart of the U.S. political system. There was entire political dynasties rose and fell on the question of central banks and the banking system and keeping the bankers in check. And I mean, obviously, one example would be Andrew Jackson, who won his second term in office, literally crusading on the slogan Jackson and no bank was his political slogan in his 1832 reelection. And he won reelection with a popular mandate to go and destroy the Second Bank of the United States, which at the time was the central bank. So this has been an incredibly important part of American political the American political life. People understood the connection between the banking system, the creation of the money, and what ultimately happened in their own pocketbooks and, you know, what they were able to purchase. That has been discoupled, deconnected, disconnected and decoupled over the past century, I think as part of a concerted effort to completely eliminate knowledge of and understanding of the banking system and how it relates to our everyday lives, as a part of a coordinated propaganda campaign that has been exceptionally successful. That functions in a lot of different ways. One of them is just to completely try to confuse people with jargon and to make things look much more complicated than they really are. As I say, the actual structure of the Federal Reserve System and what who's allowed to do what on what board and things of that is extremely complex the more you dig into it. But I think the overview is, well, there are these private banking interests that have a controlling interest in the Federal Open Market Committee that's setting the monetary policy of the United States. That is a conflict of interest. These are the same people who are sitting on the boards of the regional banks that are directing emergency bailout money to their own banks. That is a conflict of interest. It's quite easy to see the overall picture if it is displayed in stark terms like that. And it's quite easy to see, in the wake of something like the 2008 crisis, why the banking industry is such a vital part of the economy. And when it becomes this derivatives, casino, subprime, collateralized debt obligation, crazy funny money economy, as what we've seen more and more developing over the past few decades, that's when it obviously connects with people's pocketbooks, when there's a sudden, you know, a huge downturn in the economy and people start losing their jobs. So we saw an upsurge of interest in the wake of the 2008 crisis. And to a certain extent, that's part of what has led us to the point where we are now, which I think if you went back even 5 years ago, most people out there, including most people listening to this, may have heard of the Federal Reserve, but probably didn't have a good idea of even what it was, let alone what it did or how it connected in with the economy. That understanding is still obviously nowhere near where it needs to be, but a lot more people are now aware of this issue and are actually working towards it. As I point out in the third section of the documentary talking about solutions, we are at a point where End the Fed is an actual political slogan and is being wielded by, not the majority of people, but a growing and sizable minority. And that is a genuinely exciting political moment, because for the first time in over a century, it is becoming again a central part of people's thinking about the economy, about the world in general, the world we're living in. Why is money being created in this way? Who is controlling that money creation process? Is there a better way to do it? These ideas are starting to be discussed again, obviously thanks to politicians like Ron Paul and others who have popularized some of this knowledge. That is ultimately the only solution possible, is education. People have to become educated on this topic, and there are a million different ways to do it. Obviously, different people will respond to different things in different ways. Some people will respond to a documentary like the one I've created. Others would prefer it in a different form, and I'm just trying to create something out there that will at least spark some people into getting active in this.
Well, I appreciate all your work, not only on the Federal Reserve, but all your work against this New World Order system, James. So let me move on here and ask you, why do we need to understand how the money is created? Can you explain how the money is created? Because to me, if we can get people to explain how it's debt-based, then and get them to understand that it's a total scam from beginning to end, and maybe that would get more people up in arms about this corrupt system. Can you explain how they issue money into creation?
Right. Well, again, there are different forms of money that are created in different ways, so that adds some complication to it. But the vast majority of the money in the United States, in the world generally these days, is, of course, not paper, it is not coins, it is digits, it's zeros and ones in some computer database somewhere. We all understand that intuitively, but we don't actually think about that. When we think of money, we tend to think of these notes or these coins. But of course, most of the money that exists right now is just sitting in some database somewhere. It's just imaginary electronic digits. And how are those digits created is the real question. Those digits are created through the private banking system in the United States context. Obviously, it's a little bit different in each different country, but in the United States, it is the private banks that loan out their money to customers who come in for mortgages or car loans or what have you. That money is loaned into existence. A lot of people obviously think, and we're trained to think, and the language of bank lending is around this idea that there is a store of money in the bank's vaults, and they take some of that money out and they put it in your section of the bank vault. And of course, that's not what is happening. What they are doing is, through their bank charters, they are actually creating that money into existence. Now, there are some regulations about how much they can put into existence. For example, they have to have a certain amount of reserves to back up the money that they're printing, that they're creating, but they don't physically have as much money as they loan out. So that creates a system, as has been demonstrated many times in the past, where it is vulnerable to bank runs. And if everyone comes and tries to get their money at the same time, that's going to collapse the bank, which is why you need something like a lender of last resort, like the Federal Reserve, to step in and to make sure that no one bank is going to bring down the banking system by causing some sort of panic that starts to spread. So anyway, this is a long way of saying that the vast majority of money is created as debt. When people go into a bank for a bank loan, they are creating that money. And that money is created out of nothing, out of the banker's charter, but really not out of nothing. We can say it's created on the basis of the borrower's pledge to repay that loan over the course of however many years or decades. And it is really the people's labor and their repayment of that loan that is backing up that money. And once we start to realize that, we can start to realize that the middleman in all of this, the bankers, are completely useless in this creation process. All they are is a middleman who, for some reason, is given the power to create this money and, of course, given the power to collect interest on that money. So they get real money in exchange for this phony nothingness that they create out of nothing, on the back of the actual blood, sweat, and tears of the people who are laboring in the economy. And that is a system that is clearly designed by the private banking interests who own the banks and who are the only ones who really benefit from that particular form of money creation.
Yeah, well, and to get a little more technical, it's actually an accounting entry in their general ledger that they just make the entry. And they're using the U.S. taxpayers as collateral on the phony entry. And we have been battling with Ron Paul leading the charge. Now Rand Paul has introduced the legislation. I think it passed the House to actually get an audit. I mean, it's so ridiculous to me, James, that we have to beg and plead to just get an honest accounting of our monetary system. It's really out of this world to me. Do you have any thoughts about the potential audit of the Federal Reserve that's been 100 years coming?
That's right. Well, for people who don't know, it's in the U.S. Code, Section 31, Title 31, Section 714. Audit of financial institutions, examination council, Federal Reserve Board, Federal Reserve Banks, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, and Office of Comptroller of the Currency, in which it specifically lays out those parts of the Federal Reserve's books which cannot be audited by the government, by the Comptroller General. And it's pretty amazing that this, again, this entity that was created by government, this quasi-governmental agency, is not open, is not transparent to the type of examination, which is really the important part. I mean, the things you would actually want to look at, for example, the deals that the Federal Reserve has with foreign countries, with foreign central banks, its discount window operations, transactions under the Federal Open Market Committee, all of these things which are extremely important and which would tell a very different story, I think, of the bailout process of the last few years than the one that we've gotten from the official records, are, of course, the ones that are specifically off limits because of U.S. code. The actual law of the land is that the Comptroller General cannot look at those things. So the audit the Fed bill would repeal that section of the U.S. code and make that available for scrutiny by the Comptroller General. That's obviously an important step towards the people at least understanding what it is that that is going on behind those closed doors. I mean, we've seen various parts of this come out. For example, I mean, even in the legal battle that Bloomberg and others had to do to try to get some of the information out about what was happening in that bailout process was a protracted legal battle in which, again, the Federal Reserve specifically was arguing, no, our regional banks aren't open to FOIAs because they're private boards of governors. These are private banks, so you can't use FOIA against them. So again, there's some really interesting things that happen when we just try to peel away some of the layers of this onion. But I think that the audit, the Fed, I mean, obviously, I think it's an important step, but it is only a step. And I think we have to understand that ultimately, the final goal has to be the change, the fundamental change in the banking system itself, in the money creation process that we just talked about.
Well, it seems like to me they want it both ways. You know, when it serves their interest, they're private, and when it serves the public interest, they're government. And so they like to keep the ambiguity going. So their mandate, which they claim is stable prices, full employment, and a growing economy, we see none of that from them. So it seems like they're rapidly losing any credibility that they might have.
Well, not even rapidly. I mean, since the creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913, the dollar has lost 97% of its value. So if it's supposed to be some sort of stability generating mechanism, it has signally and clearly failed to do that. The employment data, I mean, again, unemployment numbers look very good on paper right now. But as anyone who's taken any look at those unemployment figures and how they're arrived at would know, they have been so completely skewed and manipulated that comparing unemployment figures today from those of 20 years ago or those of 50 years ago is utterly meaningless because they calculate them in such different ways. And of course, if you look at the labor participation rate, we have 50-year lows in terms of people actually, in terms of the percentage of the workforce that is actually participating in the economy, and other ways that you can get a handle on those figures. So employment and price stability and things of that nature are clearly, I mean, signal failures of this institution, if we were to believe that the mandate that it's been set for the Federal Reserve by Congress is really what this institution is all about. But of course, I hope what the documentary makes clear is that that is ultimately not what this institution is about. And if you want to look at the bigger long-term picture of what this institution and others like it throughout the world that are connected through the central bank of central banks in Basel, Switzerland, the Bank for International Settlements, the long-term plan is ultimately the creation of a global financial system, which will be part of and feed into a global governmental system. And I think one of the clearest ways that we can see that is in those times of crisis, what opportunities do these people at the Federal Reserve and in the associated institutions swirling around in that nexus, the Council on Foreign Relations and others, what do they try to snatch out of those crisis? And in the wake of the 2008 crisis, what we saw in the 2009 G20 meeting in London was a lot of talk about global governance, New World Order, etc. speech by Gordon Brown that I referenced in the documentary, and the creation of extremely important bodies that hardly anyone knows about, such as the Financial Stability Board, which is an offshoot. It's under the umbrella of the Bank for International Settlements that behind the scenes is going on white papers and creating the regulatory infrastructure for global banking standards that are being adopted by a number of countries. So that, for example, the idea of what we saw in Cyprus a couple of years ago with the bank bail-in, where suddenly everyone goes to their bank one day and discovers that, you know, X percent of their money is gone because it's gone to bail in to the bank to try to keep the bank afloat. That idea of a bail-in has been talked about in white papers issued by the Financial Stability Board for years now. And as numerous people have attested, it could happen in the United States tomorrow if they declared it, if they wanted it to happen. The regulatory infrastructure is already in place. So this is all going on behind the scenes. And unfortunately, again, most people don't know it's even happening because of the signal failures of the largely bankster-connected corporate media to report on these things.
Yeah, it seems that the global elitists are actually, it seems that they're trying to actually create this mess because they know that printing more money and counterfeiting more money for themselves is actually going to wreck the currency, and they just keep trying to prop it up even though they know it's going to fail. And like you said, it's setting the stage to bring in a global currency and dominate everyone. But folks, we got to go to a quick break. Here's a word from our sponsors. Folks, we're back. This is We Are Change Fresno on 1680 AM. I'm your host, Stuart Webb, along with my co-host, Sam Chaney. We're getting back to our second part of this interview with James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com. Please visit his website and purchased his DVD, his documentary, The Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. James, let's get back into the unemployment numbers real quick. We know that there's 90 million people not even being included at this point in those numbers, so that's how they're keeping it at around 6 or 7%, which is, we know, is ridiculous. And also 100 million people are on some form of government assistance. How close are we to the dollar completely? Is it going to completely collapse, or are we still propping ourselves up under these other failing currencies globally? Are we still able to remain at the top of the sinking mountain?
Well, that's exactly right. I think the analogy that's often used is the best looking house on a bad block, and that's basically the U.S. dollar at this point. It really has no global competitor in terms of currency right now. The Japanese yen is being inflated away into nothingness by a policy of the new Shinzo Abe administration in Japan to double the money supply in 2 years, something that they've almost completed by this point. So the yen is sinking. The euro, obviously, and it continues to be in crisis, and the European Central Bank is still trying to find any way it can to try to inflate themselves out of the nightmare that they're suffering through with their unemployment. Other global competitors in similar situations. So really, the U.S. dollar is paradoxically enough strengthening at this moment and is really in a relatively strong position. And that is at least in part, again, because of what we talked about earlier. In the crisis, they seized the crisis to do all sorts of things, including, of course, the quantitative easing programs that the Federal Reserve implemented, culminating in QE3, the last round of quantitative easing, which at its height was buying, I believe, $85 billion a month in mortgage-backed securities and bonds, and pumping that into the pockets of the banks that that were offloading their mortgage-backed securities to the Federal Reserve. It was which has created another huge bubble. There is amazingly enough, just 5 years after the last housing bubble, or 6 or 7 years after the last housing bubble collapsed and caused all of those problems, we are seeing the creation of another one. Certain markets in the United States are again overheating as the result of this money that's being put into the mortgage markets by the Federal Reserve, and the equities markets now just absolutely completely detached from reality, with the S&P and the Dow Jones hitting record high after record high, pulling back a little bit in the past week or so, but still up near all-time record numbers, not on the result of any economic data that would justify those types of returns, but simply on the fact that we now have an incredible amount of money sloshing around that these so-called global investors are putting primarily into equities. And there was just a report that was released a couple of months ago that estimated there are now $29 trillion in investments overall, global investments by central banks and other and national pension funds and other public institutions of that sort around the world, most of which has been pumped into the equities markets, creating bubble-like conditions, according to this report. Surprise, surprise. So we've seen the paradoxical creation of a relative advantage of the U.S. economy at the moment, which really is, again, just another bubble, because what we've really come to see is the basis of this Federal Reserve system is the creation of bubble after bubble after bubble. So we could go back to the 1999-2000 dot-com bubble. When that popped, then the Federal Reserve, at that time led by Greenspan, lowered interest rates to nearly zero, kept them there for a very, very long time in order to run up the housing bubble. When that popped, we saw the emergency bailouts, we saw the quantitative easing programs, and now we have another bubble, this time in the equities markets, and a bond bubble, which one official at the Bank of England has called the greatest bond bubble in the history of the world. So we are now living through that, and the unfortunate part of this is every time they blow up a bubble to try to save what was lost in the last bubble, the bubble grows even bigger. So each popping becomes even worse. And so if you can imagine the 2008 crisis magnified by a factor of 10, that is what we're facing when we look at the popping of the next bubble. And it's just a question of, you know, whether they'll try to blow up an even bigger bubble to save us from that. And at a certain point, obviously, that entire idea fails miserably. And it's at that point that I think we would look for the creation of that global financial infrastructure as the so-called savior to save us from this system that the banksters themselves have created.
James, isn't this the Hegelian dialectic we see them continually use against us in all these different major crises?
Well, that's exactly right. We're presented with some sort of problem, and then the solution seems to be that it has to be in a certain direction. So when we're talking about in the economic sphere, when we see these types of problems, like what happened in the banking sector in the lead-up to the subprime crash and then the crash of Lehman Brothers, what we're seeing is the creation of a narrative, and that narrative is basically that, hey, look at these banks, they blew up this incredible bubble, and that popped. So now what we need to do is we need to basically transfer the ability for that to happen. We need to make sure that doesn't happen. So we need to transfer more power towards the federal institutions, and then ultimately the international institutions that will undergird this structure. And so that's why we see, for example, the creation of things like the Financial Stability Board and other things to work on the creation of international banking regulations that will assure that this doesn't happen again. But of course, this all begs the question, because ultimately it's saying that the only possible way for us to deal with crises like what we saw just happen is the centralization of power in the hands of even fewer people. That's what this is all about. The G20, the Financial Stability Board, these are the types of things that will save us from the next crash. The idea that it could go the other way, that what we need to do is to actually decentralize the structure and to stop thinking of, for example, the creation of money as something that only the U.S. government can regulate, that it has to be a national thing, with that it has to be undergirded by legal tender laws that basically make it impossible for any human being in the United States to live without those Federal Reserve notes and other such things, which arbitrarily and needlessly restrict the ability of people to use different monetary devices. The idea that that could be dismantled and that people could actually compete in a free market of currencies, oh, that's crazy talk. That's not even on the table. That's not even on the radar. That's not something that's even discussed. And this has been something that's been discussed by I believe the monetary reform critic Bernard Leitaeder. I don't know actually how to pronounce his name, but I believe it was a speech that he made a few years ago where he talked specifically about basically the wall that is put up in the finance community in the economics field as an academic field, where if you talk about monetary reform, i.e. the fundamental thing that this is all about, the idea that we could create money in a different way, you are completely off the table. You don't get any government grants. You don't get any of the jobs which are provided by the Federal Reserve to economists. You do obviously don't get Nobel Prizes like Paul Krugman and others. You are completely basically persona non grata in the economic academic community, which is why they never talk about it. Obviously, the media has a vested interest in not talking about it. So simply by excluding the idea that we could be doing this in any other way, they're ramrodding us into this idea that the only way to deal with this is the way that they've presented with us to deal with it. And that, of course, leads us into that problem reaction solution Hegelian dialectic that leads us almost inevitably, almost it seems like there's no other way we could possibly go than in the creation of this global governmental structure.
Yeah, and what we've been seeing is that these elitists that control the federal government and all government basically, is they will not do anything. They will not make a decision that won't get them to where they want to be in their agenda. They won't make a decision that will grant them less power or give us more freedom. And these legal tender laws, I mean, really, when it comes down to it, it's a crime against humanity, because you should be able to barter, use any form of valued medium to be able to survive and function in society. But no, we have to use Federal Reserve debt notes that they counterfeit. See, if we counterfeit money, we're thrown in prison. But the Federal Reserve can literally print trillions of dollars, give it to select special interests, and nothing happens. So it's these people that are running the Federal Reserve are really, I mean, they are the worst kind of people. And like you said, it's the Hegelian dialectic. They're creating the problem, and then just they want more power to help fix the problem that they created. How do we break this conditioning? Is it just talking about it more? I really, because I talk to people about self-ownership, just basic fundamental rights that we all need to have. because government is just so out of control, what do we do? It's just absolutely out of control.
Well, I, for one, am completely averse to the idea that we're going to get some sort of political solution to this. I don't disparage the efforts of Ron Paul or others to educate people on this and to attempt things like the Audit the Fed Act, but I don't think ultimately the solution to this problem is going to come from government. I think we have to start taking responsibility for what we do with our own lives economically and financially and monetarily and in every other possible way. And it's important to understand that there are already in existence right now ways that you can start to wean yourself off the Federal Reserve note system, and there is no big silver bullet solution to all of this at this time. I mean, you're not going to get off of it completely if you want to live other than as the Unabomber, you know, foraging for twigs and berries in the woods. But if you want to live in society, unfortunately you will need Federal Reserve notes to do certain transactions, but there are already in place certain ways that you can start to get around that. And some of them that I highlight in the video include, for example, in Ithaca, New York, there's the idea of the Ithaca Hours system, which is basically a type of let system where people volunteer their time, their services, and they receive these hours in return. They're basically a form of currency called, they're denominated in hours. It's supposed to be 1 hour of work, but of course you can charge multiple hours per hour of work or what have you. But this, in Ithaca, New York, that type of system exists all over the United States. In fact, all over the world there are those types of systems. But Ithaca was a particularly successful example of that, where millions of dollars equivalent of those hours have traded hands in the last 20 or 25 years almost that's been in place. And there's many businesses in the area that accept them. You can get all sorts of different services in Ithaca through that system, including even the local credit union. So basically you can do your banking with it. There are hospitals that accept it. So it's a particularly successful example, and one that I think other communities could look to as an example of how to really institute something that can start to take away some of the power of that Federal Reserve note, that again is based more on the actual people power that really does underlie the money, rather than using the bankers as the middleman. And that's just one example, and I'm sure your listeners have heard of all sorts of other examples. There are those who want to return to a gold standard. I'm not particularly in favor of that, because I can't believe that putting the entire economy at the service of what can be mined out of the ground is a good idea. But gold as a store of value, absolutely. It's stored its value for thousands of years, and you can buy essentially the same goods with an ounce of gold today that you could 2,000 years ago. That cannot be said of any other form of money that's ever existed. So that's exceptionally important. Cryptocurrencies, I think, are important. Bitcoin. There was just a story that came out today that I just tweeted from my Twitter account that it had a rather unusual headline, considering it's from Reuters, talking about how Bitcoin, people are in Venezuela are turning to Bitcoin to quote unquote bypass socialist currency controls. And again, that's a Reuters headline talking about the currency controls that were instituted under Hugo Chavez. People are getting around them by using Bitcoin to get money in and out of the country. So people are coming up with creative ways of getting around the restrictions, and some of them exist right now. Others will be created in the future. They all need our commitment, our involvement. We have to start actually putting ourselves into this mix and starting to wean ourselves off of the system that's been created for us. Because again, unless there are alternatives that people are actually using, then when that crisis hits, we'll have no choice but to go along with whatever solution the banksters come up with, because we won't have anything in place. So while we have this moment of opportunity where we understand what is happening and we see the possibilities, and some of those possibilities already exist, it would be completely our fault if we let this moment of opportunity go by without starting to get ourselves off of this system that's enslaving us.
Yeah, there's many things that people can purchase that have value that you could trade with. I mean, anything that is valued by someone else could be, it has more value than the value of the dollar when it collapses. If they continue to print it, it's just pieces of paper. So really, we just need to hammer that into people's heads that, hey, this debt note, you can just burn it. I mean, it really, the only reason it has value is because you recognize it. And then they have a monopoly on the currency with the legal tender laws. So, yes, like you said, you don't want to put it all in gold, or, you know, like some people want to have a political movement to do that. But really what we should probably do is have our eggs in different baskets. I mean, have some Bitcoin, have some cryptocurrency, have some gold, have some ammo, have food storage, have whatever that actually has real value. And that's how we start to bypass the system, because the market's going to operate. As Ron Paul talks about, if they have a monopoly on the threat of force, money, and the government's oppressive, the market will operate underground. It will operate however it needs to. People need to survive. But like you said, we need to try to avoid this coming collapse, and the way we can do that is put our eggs in different baskets and also educate ourselves and take action.
Yes, and just to reinforce what you're saying there, just think about the prison community, where prisoners are basically prevented from using a lot of their money, so they're prevented from using money. So what do? They end up trading whatever they can, whether that's cigarettes or whatever, as a form of money. Exactly. It's the market in action, and that's exactly what happens. An example, again, that I'd point people to that I like to point out is what happened in Volos, Greece, in the wake of the euro crisis there a few years ago. Obviously, euros were very scarce, but people still needed to buy food and live, so in Volos, Greece, they created a barter system, again, a type of let system called TEM that took off and was extremely successful and helped people to survive when they couldn't get those silly pieces of paper that are printed up from the European Central Bank. So again, this happens all the time. People find ways around the system. It's happening right now. Educate yourself about what's in your area and get involved.
And so, James, we know that according to Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve is above government. And so what motivates these people, because they own the printing presses, so money is no object to them. So can you explain to our audience the mentality of the international banker, the Federal Reserve banker? What motivates these people to what end?
Well, that's an extremely important point that you just raised that I think we have to underline, which is that this, at the end of the day, this is not about money. It's not about pieces of paper, obviously, because as we've talked about, those pieces of paper themselves are meaningless and worthless except for the value that's assigned to them. And since the majority of the money is created just out of thin air by the banksters themselves, what would they care about having more of those meaningless tokens? Money is only valuable insofar as it is a proxy for power. It's about political power. It's about power over people. It's about control over resources and wealth and the things that make up the world. And when we see it in that context, at the end of the day, this isn't about money. This is about power. And so the consolidation of power that happened in 1913 with the creation of the Federal Reserve was an important stepping stone to the point we're at today, where it's so demonstrable in so many different ways that there are very, very few people at the very top of this financial pyramid that control the vast majority of the economy. And that is going to consolidate even further if things continue the way they are, until eventually we do end up in that global financial system. And I think, again, as for everyone at the bottom of that pyramid who realizes they're never going to gain anything from that and they're always going to be subject to the whims of those people with the power, the answer to that is not to go blindly marching along into the next step of this process that they've laid out for us. It is to go in the other direction and to try to find ways that we can cooperate with each other. The people in the actual productive economy who really underlie the money and back it up and do all of this themselves with their blood, sweat, and tears can harness that to create a people-powered system that's about the people themselves, not about the bankster elite. And if we continue to grasp the momentum that we have right now, we can actually push this through to something new and different, and hopefully better. And it's an uphill battle, and it's a constant struggle. I don't think we'll ever find the perfect system, but we have to continue trying, because otherwise I think the future has been sealed for us.
Yeah, you know, we preach on this show continuously that if you're a government worker, you work inside these financial institutions and whatnot, at the end of the day, you really don't benefit from the system. Maybe you're living a decent lifestyle right now, but as we went over earlier, they can pull the rug out any time. They control the interest rates. And so it's in their best interest to actually overthrow the system, isn't it?
It absolutely is. No one benefits from this except for the very few at the very top, and obviously they like to pass out scraps from their table in order to incentivize people to go along with the system, but there's always people in there that are working in various ways to get truth out, and I think we have to take advantage of that when it happens. For example, people might have seen recently a whistleblower from within the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, Carmen Segarra, has just released some recordings that she made at her time at the New York Fed, showing that the New York Fed will not go after someone like a Goldman Sachs, who really are the people who own the banking system at the end of the day. Again, that's up on ProPublica, and This American Life just had a podcast about it. I hope people will check into that. That, again, just adds more data points to this picture that shows that the banks are the ones in control, and it doesn't benefit anyone except for the people who are owning those banks.
Yeah, and the banks, the Federal Reserve, funds government. So the government's not going to prosecute these banks when they commit major crimes because they'll just fine them a couple billion dollars. But, of course, they can just print that money or just digitally input it and pay their fine, and no one goes to jail. So they're above the law, and it's all for show at this point. Any prosecution is all for show. No one will actually – nothing will actually happen. No one will actually go to the banks won't go to jail. It'll be a person they threw under the rug, like a Lois Lerner, as when it comes to the IRS scandal. And so what our audience needs to realize is that these people are ruthless. They are willing to collapse our entire system illegally, and no one's going to go to jail because our government is funded by these people, these global elitists. And so, yes, it is in the interest of self-preservation that we need to fight this, and we need to speak out against this, and if we don't, we're going to lose everything.
That is 100% correct, and it ties in directly with what's happening right now as we're starting to get news stories that the Department of Justice is set to start a quote-unquote fresh round of attacks on the world's biggest banks, end quote, from dealbook.com, the New York Times dealbook. But I think you're exactly right about this. As even Dealbook goes on to note, this is a legacy project for Eric Holder, and all they're going to do is throw a few low-level dealers under the bus. They're not going to go after any executives. It's all for show. The prosecutions that have been tried tentatively by the DOJ in the last few years are nothing compared to what should have gone on in the face of the incredible, colossal fraud that we saw with the banks literally creating crap, betting against it, selling it to their customers, and watching the whole thing go down with glee, rubbing their hands at the prospect of the billions and billions and billions in bailout money that each individual bank was going to make from all of this mess that they created. It is a disgusting system. It is an outrageous system, and it's only able to operate because the people ultimately have allowed it to operate. And I think, again, we have to do everything we can to put ourselves in the gears of this machine and to take ourselves out of the machine, because, again, it's, I think, less so than the idea of us violently opposing the machine. It's the realization that we are the ones supporting that pyramid. We're at the base holding it all up. And if we start to take ourselves out from underneath that pyramid and start to find a different way of interacting with each other directly through this incredibly empowering technology that's now available at our fingertips, we can ultimately upend that pyramid. And I think that has to be the goal.
James, it's discouraging to see, and like every price is rigged. It's all come out, you know, gold, silver, commodities. It seems like every price is rigged. So I think it's like you say, we have to innovate around their financial system because it's already been exposed as being fraudulent and rigged.
It certainly has. Yeah, the gold fix, etc. Yeah.
James, we got about 2 minutes left. Is there anything, any last words, any upcoming projects, anything you want to plug before we end this interview?
Well, first I'll just say if anyone hasn't checked out the documentary, I hope they do so. It's available 100% for free online. It's called Century of Enslavement, The History of the Federal Reserve. You can search for that on YouTube, or you can just go to my website, CorbettReport.com, And if you go to corbettreport.com/Federal Reserve, you can find the documentary and a complete transcript of the documentary with links to all of the sources that I used in the creation of the documentary. There's MP3 and MP4 downloadable versions. There's an information pamphlet. All of that there on the website. Again, 100% for free. Just get the word, get it, spread it out to other people that you think will respond to that. And of course, there are DVD copies available for sale there on the website as well.
And people should buy the hard copy, support the source of this very, very valuable and important information. And James, you also want to plug, aren't you the editor of the International Forecaster now, too?
That's right. I write the lead editorial for the Forecaster. It comes out twice a week on Wednesdays and Saturdays. So that's at theinternationalforecaster.com. And I also have my own subscriber newsletter that people can look into on the website that helps to support my work.
Awesome. James, well, thank you for joining us. Very, very important information, folks. We really appreciate it. Hope to have you on again soon. But good luck with all your upcoming projects. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate that.
Thank you, James. Support alternative media because the mainstream media is lying to you.
Exactly. Folks, we're going to take a quick break from our sponsors, and we'll head into the second hour for some news.